The Jazz Scene Podcast gives an in-depth look at the lives and stories of the musicians performing in Columbus and beyond. Today's episode is hosted by Zach Compston, Vice President of Education and Community Engagement for the Jazz Arts Group of Columbus.
Ken Poplawski, welcome to the Jazz Scene Podcast and welcome to Columbus.
Thanks. Very happy to be back here again.
And that's something I want to talk with you about. This is certainly not your first time in Columbus, and I want to learn a little bit more about your history in Columbus, because you've been playing with the Columbus Jazz Orchestra on and off for, gosh, going back in our records, which are a little bit sort of broken up, 2000 was one of the earliest years. Maybe you remember whether it was before that or not.
I have a very bad memory for dates, but that kind of makes sense. I know that it was pre-Byron Stripling. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I know that I appeared enough times before him that I was actually up for that job of music director of this.
Ah.
And I talked to them. I had a couple meetings. For me, it just wasn't the right thing at the time because, I was doing a lot of stuff in New York, mm-hmm. And I couldn't have moved then, you know, and I'll be honest with you, Byron's a friend of mine. We've known each other a long time. He's the best person to do this. Mm. He does such a great job, and I'm not just saying that because we're, you know, on air. He really does. Yeah. He does an amazing job, and I'm glad he's the one that's running this.
And he's 20 years in now, and the organization is past 50 years, and we've got a really great thing going. You are here to play a concert entitled All That Jazz, and I know you're playing some Benny Goodman and some Fletcher Henderson and some other music of sort of the swing era and big bands, your more classic charts. But in terms of you and Byron Stripling, you know, you said something off mic that you and he bring out the best, maybe the worst, but the best ultimately in each other. How far back does your relationship with Byron go? Similar duration?
Longer. I knew Byron when he was in New York. You know, he was doing that Broadway show for a while.
Right, Satchmo.
Satchmo. And I don't remember how we first got in touch. You know, in New York, it's like one big extended family.
Sure.
And sometimes the family speaks to each other and sometimes they don't, like every family. But I'd known about Byron, and I think I must have called him for a gig because I was working at a lot of clubs. And he remembers that we played a club somewhere in the 80s off of Broadway way back, I guess, in the mid to late 80s. Mm. So we go back even before his tenure here.
Yeah. I do want to kind of fill in the gaps for our audience who may not know your background. You're from Ohio.
Yes.
You're from a suburb of Cleveland.
Yeah, Garfield Heights, southeast of Cleveland.
And you grew up in what seems like a musical household, or at least you were playing music, you know, quite seriously from a young age.
Yeah, my father was an amateur musician and tried a series of instruments, failed at each one, and then passed them down to, well, my brother, who's 2 years older, got the trumpet. I got the clarinet. And this sounds like a joke, but it's not really. Had there been a third child, and had I been that third child, I'd be an accordion player now.
Because
that was his next instrument.
And polka and Polish music was...
It's the law, at least in northern Ohio,
right.
That if you're Polish and you play an instrument, you have to be in a polka band.
Right.
Or you get arrested. So my brother and I had a Polish polka band. I was 11, he was 13, maybe 12, 14. But we were out there playing local weddings, dances. We used to go on a TV show called Poker Varieties, a local show. Thank God those have all been wiped.
And by that you mean like the recordings of those shows?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it was a great way to get into the business because in that music, believe it or not, in Polish polka music, the clarinet improvises.
Right.
And it's very similar to New Orleans jazz. Every song's got three or four sections, and there's two trumpets playing together. There's sometimes a drum break at the end. real similar. And if you go back, you know, in time, you know, you could see that they, besides, you know, the African influences with New Orleans jazz, there's a big influence with European concert bands. So that whole, I don't want to get too technical, but there's a very famous New Orleans clarinet feature called High Society that every clarinetist is expected to know. And there's a little obbligato part on that that sounds exactly like a Polish polka. But that all that comes from those European concert bands.
Right. So obviously polka, you know, certainly was in the cultural foundation of where you grew up. But was there an impetus to start a band from within the family? Like, did your father say, hey, you should start a band? Or where did the idea to start a band come from?
I think it came from his frustrations as not being a great musician, which he wasn't by his own admission. So my brother and I put this band together, and you know, I'll tell you what got me interested in music. When I was 5 years old, I don't mind giving away my age, 1964, my parents took my brother and me to see A Hard Day's Night, Beatles movie, in the theater. The Beatles, seeing them in the theater and seeing the reaction of the kids in the theater to what's happening on the screen.
Yeah, an inanimate object on the screen.
Yeah, and they're screaming in the theater. And I the charisma of the Beatles and the sound of their music and their music made me think, even at 5 years old, like, this is something I want to do. This is for me. Now, and then playing polka music and playing the clarinet. Of course, I'm not going to be playing in a rock band playing clarinet. So I started listening to more jazz. Duke Ellington opened my ears to a whole world of jazz, and then Benny Goodman, people like that. And also, you know, I grew up, and as did Byron, in maybe the last golden age when all the big bands were still around, and they would all come to your school and not only do a concert, but they do a workshop for the students. And it was so exciting for us to meet these great musicians, talk to them, and then see them, you know, in an evening performance. So I would say almost from the first dollar I made playing music, I thought that this is what I want to do. And then as I got older, I started playing more and more jazz in Cleveland with some of the older musicians there, and went to college for 2 years in Cleveland and got an offer to go on the road with a ghost band, we used to call them, because the band leader had passed on. It was the Tommy Dorsey band with the trombonist Buddy Morrow leading the band. And I did that for 2 years and then moved to New York in around 1981.
The decision to go to college, you studied music in college for those 2 years?
I did, yes.
Okay. Yeah. You know, nowadays, especially, you know, in Midwestern cities, if you want to study music, you go to a 4 year college a lot of times and consider grad school and on from there. It seemed more common in your generation. My father as well went to Berkeley for 2 years, then left, came home. He ended up finishing later a degree. But it seemed more common in those days to have a legitimate reason to maybe leave school and go work. You hear about Jeff Hamilton going to Indiana University for a year or two, and others, Byron as well at Eastman. What was the feeling from your parents as you were in school? Of course, you were already playing professionally. Were they cool with all of those decisions that ultimately landed you in New York and as a professional, or some
actually
friction
not really
there?
They were cool with me staying in Cleveland playing with my brother, but branching out on my own, not at all. To be quite honest, they were pretty negative about it, but I so wanted to do it.
Sure.
I just did it, you know. And college, you're right. In those days, college wasn't something that you felt you had to do, especially as a musician, because there were all those big bands were around. That was a great alternative to college back then. There's nothing that helps you learn faster as a musician or grow as a musician than playing every night in a band, sometimes doing the same songs every night, you know, and you have to make it sound fresh every time. There's a whole discipline to that. And we were on the road 48 weeks out of the year.
Wow.
Doing mostly one-nighters. Mm. So it's a tough job, and it's a job for young musicians, really. And there were a lot more gigs, too, back then. You know, restaurants, every hotel had a band of some sort. Mm-hmm. So you were just playing a lot. And I tell students, I think you were at a workshop I did the other day where I was telling them, you know, there are less opportunities now for you, but that doesn't mean you can't make your own.
Right.
You know, so I always tell students, you know, go to the local coffee shop or restaurant. You know, a lot of times Monday nights are slow, maybe a Sunday night. Ask them if you can play there, you know, for either little money or the door. And then if you're drawing an audience, you can increase your fee as you go. Mm-hmm. And I think that is happening with the really industrious musicians out there. I can see that they're making their own world for themselves.
And the idea that college isn't it is a bit of a vacuum, meaning you have to leave there. It can get you really far, but eventually you have to find your way out in the, quote, real world. You know, I hate not to be cliche about it, but that not everything that is going to be your career can be contained in the higher education world. In fact, so many things you have yet to learn are out beyond the walls of the college that you go to.
Very true.
Yeah.
And in fact, I mentioned to get off mic, I've got two boys that live in Sweden, and they're 22 and 24 now. And an interesting thing in that country, because college is free, as is healthcare and all kinds of other things that don't get me started on this. But because of that, they don't feel this urge that they've got to go to college right away or even have to go at all. And also, the wages over there are not, let me put it this way. If you work as a janitor in a school versus being a teacher, you're still being well taken care of.
Right.
And you're getting great free health care and all kinds of things. So you're not pressured to have to immediately go into a college. And my kids are experiencing this now. They have yet to go to college. They're trying out different jobs, traveling a little bit, and really figuring out what they want to do. And right. I kind of like that system.
Well, it's something we spoke about in the car between, you know, the hotel and the schools is then you add the factor that the global pandemic caused to young people. And your kids are still in their early 20s.
Yeah.
You know, that formative period where, you know, previously it maybe made sense to sort of get your four-year degree and then sort of decide what you want to do. But COVID, especially if you were college age during COVID, sort of changed the rules on everything because college no longer may no longer serve the need that you had to go. Now you're on Zoom and you're paying money. You know, it's just I feel like the stakes kind of got higher in terms of making a big risky decision, like spending all your money to be on Zoom. And, you know, just I think it changed the game for the way that a lot of young people are considering their future.
It sure did. And not just from an educational standpoint, also obviously from a social standpoint. And it's not just hearsay. I mean, there's all kinds of psychological studies already showing that a lot of younger people – their social skills are really stunted from that pretty much 2 year period where they just sat at home behind a screen with no real human interaction, you know, besides looking at each other, you know, staring at each other.
Well, getting back to music and particularly your influences, you mentioned something about being on the road and sort of the grind and it's a serious commitment to be on the road playing. And something I've read that you cited was Sonny Stitt as an influence for that. Somebody who spent his living and his entire life rather on the road. And you've said in various settings, playing with different rhythm sections, sometimes good, sometimes not. And that Sonny Stitt is an inspiration because of his consistency. He shows up to the bandstand the same way or, you know, talk about Sonny Stitt for a moment and just his influence on you personally and musically.
Sure. To me, one of the all time great jazz saxophonists, and played alto, tenor and baritone equally well. And incidentally, I learned this from taking some lessons from him. The first lesson, I brought this giant fake book of like 1,001 songs, and he was riff riffing through the table of contents and just picking songs at random, picking horns at random that were all laying on his bed, and keys at random.
Wow.
So he, you know, from all those years of just going through the American Songbook repertoire, he developed a real interesting way of learning songs and getting to know him a bit and talking to him. He couldn't explain things technically well. Like now, if you talk to a college professor, you know, they'll say, oh, this song has a 2-5-1 progression, you know, and the bridge goes to the sixth chord and then it goes to this. He couldn't say any of that. What he would do was he'd play a song and then he'd say, well, you could try this, you know, when you get to this chord, and then I'd figure out, okay, this is what he's doing, you know, like it's a diminished scale or it's, you know, this. But, you know, going back to his lifestyle, yeah, I do. I found, ironically, my whole career has been kind of a pale imitation of what he was doing for many years, with one exception. You know, he traveled his whole life, never really had a solid band of his own. I do in New York, but, you know, because of the economics around the world now, it's harder and harder to travel with a band.
Sure.
But he always played with local rhythm sections. And in those days, you know, the big cities, you were guaranteed a great rhythm section. If you went to a smaller town, probably not. Mm-hmm. But he worked out a discipline of playing consistently well no matter what was happening around him. And he would even talk about this. He'd say, you know, if you're playing with, let's say, piano, bass, and drums, you think of that as three sets of doors that you could open or close. Mm. So if you can lock in, let's say, with a drummer and feel like you're playing in sync with him, that's a door you keep open. If the bass player has no idea what he's doing, for example, and doesn't know the chord changes or the songs, you can kind of close that door mentally, you know, and you just learn to block out the bad and open yourself up to the good. And it is a hard thing to do, because sometimes if you do a whole string of bad rhythm sections, then you have to remind yourself, now I can open up again and, and play actual music with the people I'm with on the bandstand instead of just for and by myself, you know.
But it puts a sense of personal accountability to your craft. It puts the ball in your court.
Yeah.
That there's something you could, there's always something you can do.
Absolutely.
On your instrument to make the moment happen.
Well, as a matter of fact, his playing was so strong, and we talked about this again the other day, and I tell students this. Now you can, of course, with AI, you can do this. If you pulled just him out of a recording, and just listen to him, all the information is there. The sense of time, the chord changes, the great melodic sense, the forward motion that he had in playing, the arc of his solos, everything's there that you'd need to know about playing whatever the song was he was playing.
Yeah.
And he could lift a rhythm section with his incredible sense of time and changes and teach them along the way. And I would like to say, you know, I could do that to some extent myself, because I've had to.
Yeah.
I've had to learn to do that. Thank God I do have some great players, not just in New York now, but everywhere. As I said, that's changed. Because there's less venues to play, so many great musicians now are accepting teaching positions in even smaller towns. So that means, for people like me, I'm going to find at least one good rhythm section everywhere I go.
Yep.
So that's a luxury. And then you can play off of them, because I don't like to be just the soloist with accompanist. Mm-hmm. I want to make music with everybody.
Right.
You know?
Right. Coming back to you, and in fact, you moved to New York City shortly after the time in the Tommy Dorsey Band.
Yes.
And have since called that your home, I believe, without any time away, that you've been in New York the whole time. What are some of the highlights of having been in New York What has that afforded with you in terms of who you've gotten to play with? Just as you look back on 30-plus years in New York, highlights of living in the biggest city, certainly for jazz, arguably in the world.
Sure.
You know, what are some of the things you look back on and go, wow, I got to play with these folks or got these experiences?
Yeah, you mean like getting robbed the first year?
Exactly.
Oh, wait,
not
the good experiences. Exactly. Okay.
Take the good with the bad.
Actually, that did happen. But at gunpoint, no less.
Oh, my gosh.
But those were rough years in New York in the early 80s. It's a much better, different place now. So many good experiences. I was talking to Byron about this last night. We were lucky because we kind of caught the tail end of the last wave of, I guess, for lack of a better description, the classic kind of standards-based players. Mm-hmm. So I got to know, you know, these, like the great guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli, the bassist Milt Hinton. I was playing with the bassist George DeVivier, Hank Jones, the piano player, horn players galore, you know, that were idols of mine, you know, Flip Phillips, Illinois Jacquette, Benny Carter, people that are still around, you know, Randy Brecker, I see every now and then, do some gigs with him.
Right.
Houston Person, who's going to be 90 this year, and he's one of my best friends, and we work together a lot. And back then, there was a real feeling, it was like a family in New York. Mm. So when somebody new came in, they'd check you out to see if you could play and put you through the ringer a little bit in a good way, in a friendly, hazing kind of way. But
sure.
Just to see if you could figure out, you know, they call a song that you'd never heard before, and you might have to take the first solo. So it's amazing what adrenaline and fear can do to your playing.
Yeah,
and I'm not kidding, you know, all the way, because it makes you learn faster. Believe me. And again, I tell students you can kind of recreate that. In your setting yourself by, you know, when you book a gig for yourself, call some songs that are not familiar to you. And, you know, even if you have to put a sheet of music up there at first to learn it, you will learn much faster when you're that focused and you've got to play in front of an audience and fellow musicians too.
So looking at Ken Poplawski, the recording artist, you've recorded tens and tens, I think probably over 60, 70 records at this point.
Yeah.
There's so much amazing output. And what I'm struck by is sometimes it's thematic, you're playing the music of. Other times it's maybe more orchestration-based, like one of your more recent records is with a big band.
Yes.
One of your other more recent records is with just you and guitar.
Yeah.
What are some of the goals that you go into the studio with? And I'm sure it changes.
Yeah.
But when you think about capturing your music, what are some of the top things that you're aiming to do at a given time, especially now that you've put out so much music? What do you go into the studio aiming to achieve beyond just the amazing music and which comes across in all of your recordings?
Well, thank you. And there's a few things. First off, I can tell you that every record I've made under my name has been, almost 100% of them have been recorded virtually live in the studio. Mm. Saying that, what I mean is we're all pretty much in the same room, not isolated in booths. I've had sessions where, for other labels, where the producer insists on separating us, and I tend not to like that because, again, I like to pressure myself, and I feel I play better when I put that pressure on myself. And if I'm in the room with people, all the instruments are bleeding into each other's microphones. You know, you can't separate the instruments.
Right.
Even if you've got a glass partition, you can still hear some of the leakage from. So you can't, when you're that close together, you can't go back and fix a solo or redo something unless the whole band goes in. And so most of my records, there's very, very little editing. If we screw up an ending, we might fix that. Or if somebody really hates their solo, and it takes a lot for me to, you know, do another pass, then we will. But even that big band record you mentioned, I wanted to do it. I'm not comparing myself to him, but I wanted to do it like a Sinatra record. We're all in the same big room, and I was standing right next to the reeds. So every solo I played, that had to be the one, or else I'd have to make the whole band play the whole thing again.
Do you think, so to record that way, and I think for those people that aren't as privy to how records are made, as you said earlier, so often we isolate instruments, and sometimes, even in jazz, we overdub.
Yeah.
You know, where you put a solo on later or put an instrument on later. In addition to your own preparation for that live moment, do you think that that brings out a different energy from the ensemble to be all in the same room, you know, basically duplicating what you said for yourself? Everybody's, you know, for better or for worse, on, you know, and accountable to each other.
Yes.
And do you think that there's that leads to a better outcome?
It usually does. And over the years, I could say it does 100% now, because I've found the right people to call, you know, that can relax in that situation. Because that's the worst thing, too. If you tense up and you're thinking too much about what you're going to play, it's all over. You know, then you don't stand a chance, you know. So I think it does make for better music, for at least for jazz music, because the whole point of this music is we're playing off of each other, around each other, listening to each other, getting ideas. And, you know, every performance is a one-of-a-kind performance. And, you know, the other thing to touch on about this, there's a certain sterile quality to all, not just jazz music now, because I'm not a jazz snob at all. I told you my first influence was the Beatles, and I still listen to everything. Because I just want to know what's out there, you know. So I listen to pop music, R&B, everything. And I've noticed this across the board. A lot. What bothers me about a lot of contemporary music of every genre is there's a sterile sound to it, and partly it's because of the way the music's recorded. Mm. If every instrument is isolated and separated, then you hear every instrument as a separate entity, instead of hearing the band.
Right.
And if we go back to the Beatles, for example, but there's much more current examples, but they recorded all their basic tracks. Of course, they did a lot of overdubbing later, but we have all the session tapes.
Yeah.
And I'm a big collector, incidentally. I've got all those session tapes, videos, you name it. You can hear them all playing together in the studio as a great band. And even fashioning their arrangements on the spot as they go. And again, it's that pressure. You know, we've got, back then, their first record they did in one day.
Right.
You know, so it's like, okay, we've only got whatever it is, 12, 14 hours. We've got to crank out a record. We better produce the goods, you know.
I think as audiences listen to you play, and hopefully audiences that come to the theater, but also audiences that can maybe check out our recording of this show that will come out a couple weeks after, or any of your output, I think knowing that, there is a sense of sort of bravery or confidence in your playing that has afforded you to
some
do...
Some would say stupidity, but... Yeah.
You know, everything, you know, what's life without some calculated risks, you
That's
know?
True.
But your ability to play duo, you know, and hold down the time so confidently, and you stress to the students the same thing. I also read a quote that you had about the process of rehearsing with Benny Goodman's band, that was an element where he would take the rhythm section out of the equation and rehearse the winds with no sense of time feel, no hi-hat sort of going. And adding all this together, including the Sonny Stitt influence, seems to me like you prefer, much like a quarterback wants the ball in the last 2 minutes down one score, that's kind of how you like to play when you can create in, I don't want to say high pressure because there's no jazz emergencies or, you know, we're not, you know, but in a way that creates that adrenaline moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. And at the same time, I try to keep everybody relaxed.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'd like to, I do joke around a fair amount. I take the music seriously. but I have fun while I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that I work with know this, so they trust me.
Yeah.
So they know that, you know, we could have 2 minutes to go in the game and it'll work out fine.
Yeah.
If they just don't think too much, just go with whatever crazy ideas are. I have a record coming out, if I may plug this.
Yeah, please.
It's out actually in 2 weeks. It's called The Unheard Bird. And I did every August at Birdland, Charlie Parker's birthday week, I do Bird with Strings. This year, some friends of mine that run a company called E-Jazz Lines, mm-hmm. I'm sure you
we guys just have funny, we just a purchased a chart today for our education programs.
Yeah. So I was looking for some charts that I hadn't performed before at Birdland, and I saw some titles that I was thinking, wait a minute, Bird hasn't recorded these with strings. So I called up Rob Dubois mm-hmm. there at E-Jazz Lines, and he said, we're talking to the estates of Charlie Parker. There were two ex-wives, two widows, and they found about 20 arrangements that he'd commissioned for strings and never got to record.
Wow.
And they'd just started publishing them, and so they went ahead and rushed through everything and sent me everything ahead of time, and, you know, copied all the parts for me. Did me a big favor and even wrote, you know, B-flat parts for, it was me and Terrell, I had Terrell Stafford, the trumpet player, as a guest too. And what I did on this one to keep that relaxed feel, because these were written for, five strings, harp, oboe, rhythm section and horn. And, so for the string players, I thought, okay, I want to record this because nobody's heard this stuff. So we did this week at Birdland. It's five nights, two shows a night. That's 10 shows.
Wow.
What better way to rehearse?
Mm-hmm.
So we went immediately into the studio after that on the Sunday and Monday after and recorded, again, all in the same room and just played like we were at the club. And by that time, they were so comfortable with the music. They were just having fun and a lot of first and maybe second takes on everything.
I can't wait to hear that.
Well, thanks.
That's going to be amazing.
I may have a copy here for you too.
We should consider bringing that back to Columbus. Take that project on the road.
I would love to. It's an easy project to do because, as I said, I think he had these commissioned for a smaller ensemble, frankly, so he could make some money doing it because he was really proud of his strings recordings. But most of those were for bigger groups. And this is, you know, three violins, viola, cello, and then rhythm section. So it would have been an easier, more compact group to travel with.
Listening to you talk about this project, and of course having you here, and I was the librarian years ago when you were here last with the big band, and since you brought the duo, I'm so inspired by your love of the music. And that hasn't, in recent years, probably been always the easiest. You've overcome a battle with cancer, and are on the, you know, God willing, you're at the end of that, and you know, you've gone through adversity, and the whole music community's, you know, cheered you on and supported. My question on that is, how have you been able to maintain the perspective in your life, and where has music played a role in the perspective? Because, you know, here you are. You've gone through a global pandemic while being ill, and here you are, sounding amazing, putting out projects.
Thanks.
Just where does music fit at this point, you know, as you go through the life of it all, not just the music of it
all?
Well,
it was pretty tough,
I
have to be honest. And the order that things happened made it even more depressing, if that's possible, because the pandemic hit first. And I got COVID early on in March of 2020. And it was pretty bad, too. I had like 103 fever. And in New York back then, maybe everywhere, nobody knew how to treat this stuff. And the doctor even told me, he said, if you can stay home, don't go to the hospital. Because they don't know how to treat it.
Right.
And you could get worse.
Yeah.
So that I did that. Had long-term COVID symptoms, some of which I still have. And so that was 2020. April of 2021, my little dog, Honey Pie, had to be put to sleep.
Aww.
So this is going into year two of no work,
right,
for musicians with the pandemic. And I think people, just to jump forward a little bit, I think it's important for a lot of people to realize that the music business has not really completely bounced back.
Right.
And far from it, in fact. I'd say a conservative guess would be 75% back, you know, because a lot of the medium to smaller sized venues just closed up for good during that time. So it's not, you know, we still need, and I'm sure you guys, you know, we need help from people.
Right.
We need financial help for this kind of music, just like classical music does. It's a small percentage of the audience, maybe even smaller now post-pandemic.
Sure.
So April of 2021. Then June, I get diagnosed with multiple myeloma of 2021, which is a cancer that they don't consider ever cured, but you could stay in remission for your whole life.
Yeah.
But, I got so depressed because I had a real bad time with the treatment,
yeah,
too. Worse than the cancer, frankly, because they caught the cancer on the early side, and the treatment, I lost 85 pounds. And I was overweight, but not that much, you know. So I had to struggle to keep the weight on. I was canceling most of my work. And the jobs I was playing, I told you this the other day, mm-hmm, between the cancer and the treatment, your muscles get weak. So my embouchure, and for people that don't know what that is, that's around your mouth, your lip formation and the muscles that form around the mouthpiece when you play. The embouchure muscles were weak too. So when I first started playing gigs, I'd have to play short phrases because the muscles would just blow out.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't sustain a long phrase. So I practiced more than I have my entire life to try to get that back because I'm my own worst critic. I never listen to my records. I don't. I know people say that.
I can understand
I honestly
that.
Don't.
Yeah.
I feel like it's watching a home movie over and over. And I don't want to be listening going, oh, I wish I would have done that.
Right.
I wish I would have done that. It's done. The way I look at it, a record is a literal record of how you played on that day and time.
Right.
And then you have to let it go. And you move on to the next project, you know, and not obsess over it. But I was so depressed. September of 2021. So you don't bleep this out. I'll just use the... I'll use part of the word. I woke up in the morning of September 21, living by myself because my dog had to be put to sleep.
Sure.
And my girlfriend is in Queens. I'm in Manhattan. I woke up in the morning and said out loud, F it, I need another dog. Because I thought, I got to do something to jog myself out of this funk.
Yeah.
I didn't even, honestly, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to get back and play again.
Yeah.
Or even if there'd be a music business,
right,
you know,
right,
at that point. So I got a bigger dog. I adopted this dog named Corky because he has a corkscrew tail. He's 43 pounds. And in my neighborhood, the dog park, which is the biggest dog park in Manhattan, to get to the dog park, you have to climb up a steep hill followed by three steep sets of stairs. So I thought, he's going to keep me alive.
Yeah.
I've got to stay alive for this guy.
Yep.
And vice versa, you know, hopefully. And so the great exercise, you know, and that really helped me a lot, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, and not to dwell on negative stuff, but my childhood wasn't an easy one either. Lots of my parents were very abusive and...
Mm.
It was a pretty tough childhood, to be honest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've talked about this before. And so I've learned over the years the hard way, you know, how to kind of constantly learn how to be my own best friend in a sense, and find something that you can cling to that's positive, that keeps you going through all kinds of adversity, you know. And so that dog actually getting corky was a physical manifestation of that.
Wow.
And then playing again, as I told you, at first I felt really bad because I felt like, geez, I'm cheating these people. I'm not, you know, everybody was so supportive.
Yeah.
I'll gonna start crying if I talk about it, but
yeah,
like so kind.
Yeah.
Byron, too, sending me message, you know, inspirational
messages. We were talking about you, you know, because Byron and I were doing a lot of those live stream things in a very quarantined situation. And I felt like you were the topic of conversation quite often, just because of how much you mean to Columbus and to Byron and our organization. So, and
financially, it was a killer.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm sure.
Because I've never had a full-time teaching job. I love to teach. I do a lot of master classes. I do Zoom lessons, you know, private lessons.
Sure.
But I've never taken a teaching job. I've only ever worked for myself for people like Benny or Mel Torme.
Yep.
But, you know, worked traveling around as a working musician. So who would have predicted not only a worldwide disease that canceled everything in the world for almost two years, mm-hmm. and then a debilitating disease of my own, that took me, you know, at least a year and a half to really feel like I was starting to pull out of.
And this is what I mean, though, is to see you now, and, I'm so excited to hear you from the stage open tomorrow night on Thursday. What comes across with people and is this positivity, this optimism, and it sounds like that's what carried you through those dark times.
Oh, yeah.
What was, briefly, and I know I want to be mindful of your time, what was your relationship with the horn like as you were attempting to build back the strength? And, was that respite? Was that hard work? You sort of shared with me earlier that there was some hard work involved.
Yeah. It was hard work.
Yeah.
Because especially, the clarinet is a more demanding and unforgiving instrument than the saxophone. And that... Boy, if your chops aren't at 100%, you really notice it.
Sure.
Because it's a tighter, smaller embouchure too. Mm-hmm. So those muscles really have to be focused and in place. And
so
the practicing was depressing for a long time because it just didn't feel good.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you again, a positive thing is feeding off of the audience's energy, and they were so kind to me and so nice. And not only, you know, coming off of, because I am in remission now, I have to tell everybody that because I don't want them to feel bad for me still,
right.
You know.
It's amazing.
But coming off of the pandemic and cancer, but especially the pandemic, to see the looks on people's faces, and I'm sure you all experienced this here, when they first started coming back to live music, I think people really did forget how different of an experience that was collectively experiencing music like that.
Yeah.
And in fact, going back to younger people and, you know, what almost 2 years of sitting behind a screen did to them, I think it's part of our jobs to remind them about that. Like, you know, especially jazz. Because if you go to a jazz concert, I equate it to walking a tightrope because you never know what's going to happen. Every performance is going to be different. You can hear the same 10 songs 7 days in a row, and they'll be different every night.
Right.
And if we remind people about the excitement of that, that helps bring them in, you know.
And that's a perfect segue, because as we were recording this, you're about to go into rehearsal, the final rehearsal before the show week. The shows begin on Thursday. And I just want to say you have deserved every ounce of kindness,
thank you.
Because when you show up in a city like Columbus or even in your home in New York, you give 110% of yourself to the audience, to your colleagues. It's having the privilege of having you here and been around for multiple of your visits. I'm always inspired, and we can't wait to hear you on our stage, but we encourage our listeners to seek out Ken Poplawski's music, the new recording coming out in a couple of weeks. Continue to follow us on social media, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, to see the result of this show. And just from the bottom of Jag's heart and my heart, Ken, thank you for the time, and keep on making music, and thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, and thanks for having me here. And I'm so grateful to be back in Columbus with these wonderful musicians, great staff, everybody. So thank you.
The Jazz Scene is presented by Jazz Arts Group of Columbus, America's oldest nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the art of jazz. Our theme music is titled 3/4 Times by Michael Cox. This episode was produced and engineered by Carly Kine Law. Subscribe to The Jazz Scene wherever you get your podcasts.